For coming, and particularly, I always love just listening to the sounds of a Beit Midrash. So I thank you all for providing what was really sounded like a really great chavrut. I hope it was. Let me start by saying in advance that this is a difficult shir. Not so much in the sense that it's an intellectually difficult shir, but it's a shir on a difficult topic. And it's also the first time I'm giving it, so I hope you'll cut me a little bit of slack, and also that you'll help me along. Smoothing out the rough parts in the argument, because if I say it's the first time I'm giving it, I'm not 100% sure of where I'm going on all areas, so please feel free to participate and to tell me where you think I could make the point better, or if you think I'm completely wrong. Also, one acknowledgement is necessary at the outset, and then I will point out that acknowledgement itself requires a separate acknowledgement when we get there, because the thing I'm going to acknowledge is, I think, although it's not footnoted, I think based on something earlier. What I want to footnote, quoting somebody I rarely quote in a magazine I rarely quote, I want to give credit to an article by a woman named Rachel Adler, on whom I agree with very little, who published an article in, I think, the third edition of Tikkun, a magazine I read very rarely, which is a stunningly brilliant reading of the Boreas story, and really, which first really got me interested in it. It's an article called The Virgin in the Brothel and Other Anomalies, Character and Context in the Legend of Buria. And much of what I'm going to say tonight is drawn from her presentation, although as you'll see at the end, I'm going to argue that I disagree with her in some ways fundamentally, but I agree with her analysis in some ways very strongly. My readings of the story are almost all taken from her, so I want to acknowledge that at the outset. The article is called The Virgin in the Brothel and Other Anomalies, Character and Context in the Legend of Buria. Okay, so let's start. Actually, one other proviso is necessary at the beginning. I should say that there's an old Hasidic story which is told about many different people, which, as you'll see, is an important detail of the story. That of somebody, one rabbi telling a student that anyone who believes all the miracle stories about Hasidic rabbis, right, is an idiot, and anybody who believes none of them is a heretic, and you have to, right, sort of remain, you know, some of them are true, but I don't know which ones. Okay, I'm taking that attitude basically towards the stories of Buria. Right, some of them have elements in them that seem to imply that you shouldn't take them literally, as, for example, right, they have, you know, they have all sorts of miraculous interventions. Some of them may have been stories simply told about one woman or another, which happened to get told about Buria too. As for example, one of the stories you've probably read, the famous story about Buria telling her husband, or at least Rav Meir's wife, who we assume for the purposes of for these purposes is Buria, we don't know how many wives Rav Meir had, tells him to pray for the people in his neighborhood to repent, as opposed to die. So that story is also told about the wife of Abba Chilkia, for example, right? So I don't necessarily assume that all these stories are told about the historical Buria, but I'm going to present as if it's a single story. Okay, so I want to start with source number one. Okay, source number one begins with a beautiful story that I really put in mostly because you should start this difficult shiur off with a beautiful story about Rav Chanina ben Tradion's martyrdom. If there can be a beautiful story about martyrdom, right, with a great line, right, you know, the parchment is burning, but the letters are flying. In the aftermath of the death of Rav Chanina ben Tradion, his daughter, in which one of his daughters, presumably not Buria, is sentenced by the Romans to serve, right, to serve in a brothel. So Buria tells her husband, Rav Meir, you know what? I find it personally degrading that my sister is in a brothel. Okay, so she sends Rav Meir off on a rescue mission. Rav Meir comes up with this peculiarly ambivalent phrase, right? And I tried to maintain it in the translation. He says, well, if a sin has been done with her, then a miracle will be done to save her. And if she has not sinned, right, sorry, if she, right, and it, right, if she has sinned, then a miracle won't be done with her, right? But there's an in-between line, right? She could have been used for sin without sinning. Right? If she has been used for sin, right, then a miracle, right, right. If she hasn't been used for sin, then a miracle will be done for her. If she has sinned, then a miracle won't be done for her. What if she's been used but she hasn't sinned? Okay, so that condition, right, that situation We really don't know, right? The Gemara doesn't really address that situation. But she passes. Apparently, somehow, right, she's managed, right, her mayor comes to the conclusion that she's come up with a series of verbal defenses, right, which has protected her chastity in the brothel, right? That's version in the brothel number one. What isn't asked anywhere here, right, is whether Rav Meir is tempted once being in a brothel. Right, Rav Meir, right, so there are really two virgins in the brothel, right? There's Rav Meir, and there's the daughter of Chanina ben Tradion. And we discover that the daughter of Chanina ben Tradion, is capable of defending her chastity in this situation. So Rav Meir performs a miracle, or right, he gives the guard a right to perform a miracle, and he performs some miracles in advance also. So they're saved. Somehow, Rav Meir's miracles work for Rav Chanina ben Tradion's daughter, but they don't work for himself. Right? So Rav Meir has to escape, even though he has the capacity to miraculously protect everyone else. He escapes by pretending to violate halacha. Okay, in one of two ways, right? Either by eating trey food, or because, right, or he hugs Eliyahu HaNavi, who appears as a prostitute, as someone pointed out. It's not entirely clear in the story that Rav Meir is aware that the person he is hugging is Eliyahu HaNavi. We know that it worked out that the person he hugged is Eliyahu HaNavi. We don't know whether Rav Meir knows that. But the Romans are sure that Rav Meir could never engage in this kind of behavior, and so they let Rav Meir escape. We know that it's probably fortunate that nobody else needed to miraculously save Rav Meir, because had they, right, they would have assumed he failed the test, right? Because they would have watched him, right, and they would have failed, right? So Rav Meir, right, there's no mention of Rav Meir as being tempted, and there's no concern really, right, for appearances in the case of Rav Meir, right? His reputation is entirely intact. Okay, that's the end of the story, except somehow at the end of the story, Rav Meir is forced to flee. Right, and we don't know why he's forced to flee. The Gemara says either somehow he was forced to flee because of this episode, and or he was forced to flee because of an episode involving Berea. Okay, now why would he have been forced to flee because of this episode? Two possibilities to start. He could have been forced to flee because he got away once by faking this behavior, but nonetheless, right, how many times is he going to find, right, is he going to be able to fake eating trey food? Eventually they'll figure out, you know, that guy who looks exactly like Rav Meir, right, remember his face is carved, right, there's a wanted poster carved into the gates of Rome, right, eventually they'll figure out, you know what, this must be, really be Rav Meir. Or it's possible he fled because I was wrong, and people, right, and people said, you know, that Rav Meir, that famous Rav Meir, he was seen hugging a prostitute, right, and so he fled out of shame. Okay, there's two possibilities why Rav Meir flees in the first story. Second possibility is the episode involving Berea, which the Gemara doesn't tell us what that is. Rashi tells us what the episode involving Berea is. We have no other record of this story. Okay, the only record we have of this story is in Rashi. And Rashi tells us that Berea once mocked the sage's statement that women's minds rule lightly over them, which is the best I can translate the famous phrase, Nashim Datein Kalot. It doesn't refer to intellectual ability. Right? In context, it refers to ability to be seduced easily. Okay, so Berea makes fun of this statement that women can be seduced easily. And Rav Meir tells her, you know what, I'm going to prove to you that the sage's words are right. And so he orders one of his students to tempt her. After a long while, she gives in. It's not clear whether she gives in actually or she gives in, right, or she just agrees to an assignation. She finds out that somehow that it was all just Rav Meir trying to win the argument, and she commits suicide. Okay, the question I want to ask is, does this story in any way flow from the story we just read? Okay, right, if I asked you, right, the character of Berea as presented in the story in Avodah Zarah, right? In any way, does that tell you that Berea mocks the sage's words? Right? Anyway, does it tell you that Berea is the kind of person who is or is not subject to temptation? Right? Who's likely to give in under pressure? Right? Anybody see any clue in the story?
I think one of the things is, yeah, the first story, I mean, she comes out as being rather reprehensible, sets it of her sisters in the brothel. She doesn't say, get my sister out of the brothel, what a terrible place. It degrades me, she says.
Okay, so you think she's self-interested?
Yeah.
Okay, that could be. On the other hand, it may be that that was the way to get Rivmeir to act. I don't know. But that's a good point. But, okay, so you do see, right, so you can argue that there's one negative portrait of her there. But it's not along the same lines, though, right? There's no mocking of sages.
No.
Right, there's no, right? Okay. Okay. I accept the possibility, well, I'm not convinced, necessarily. And also, right, and, right, in fact, we know that her sister is, right, under much worse circumstances, is completely chaste. Okay, so wherever this story comes from, it doesn't come from here. Okay? It's not the inevitable ending of this story. Right? So the question we ask ourselves, okay, where does it come from then? Right? Where would we get the idea that Bruria is the kind of woman, who, right, A, would mock the sages, and B, would surrender this kind of temptation? Or why would we want to tell this story about her? Okay, so first I want you to take a look at source. Well, she commits suicide. Okay, that's interesting. In the story, why did she commit suicide out of shame, presumably? Right? Now, the question is, does she commit suicide out of shame because she gave in to seduction or because she lost the argument? We don't know.
But why wouldn't she?
Or that her husband shouldn't
have. The worst thing you can do.
All right, yes and no. Yes and no. I did put the first story, the first part of the story in for a little bit of a reason, because you have the Roman, the Roman procurator, right, who commits suicide and earns a lam haba in the process. So I'm not sure in this story that, okay, maybe, right, and here you get into, you know, the notion of whether suicide, al-Kiddush Hashem, so to speak, has any kind of Jewish warrant is involved in the whole Masada debate and the Shaul debate. So I don't want to go there. Okay. Source number three, right, tells us, right, in a sense, if source number three knows about Rashi, it doesn't seem to be saying nice things about the story. Because in source number three, we discover that Rav Meir, at one point, used to mock sexual sinners, and then he discovers that he himself is every bit as susceptible as anyone else. Right? And it's only a miraculous intervention, right? A heavenly voice comes and a heavenly voice comes and says, Satan, you should take heed of Rav Meir and his Torah, right? And this is part of a genre of stories, right? So there are a whole series of stories in which rabbis are tempted, right? And as they're about, right, Rav Meir climbs across a river on the rope, Rabbi Akiva, right, climbs a really tall palm tree. Right, all this, right, and all, somewhere in the middle, a heavenly voice comes out and says, "Take heed of Rabbi so and so," right, and the Satan abandons him. Right, so we discover that Rav Meir used to mock these people, and then in the end, Rav Meir discovers that there's no point mocking them because he is as susceptible as they. Now, of course, we could ask if we treat this as a chronological story, right? Does the episode with Bruria, when it, right, happened before Rav Meir discovers his own temptation, or after? Ah, right, so it could be before, and Rav Meir, of course, would never have done this, had he known, right? And also, had Rav Meir known how tempted he was, he would never have gone into the brothel after Bruria's sister either, right? Because he would have known, I'm a human being also, what am I doing there? Right, so we could argue, right, that you have, right, Rav Meir, you know, at one point, you know, mocks all these other people, and, right, and that leads to one good consequence, he rescues the sister, although after imposing a fairly serious test on her, right, as to whether he's going to get her out or not. Right, there's no real sympathy for her position. And then at the end, right, we understand, of course, Rav Meir realizes his own humanity, and perhaps, right, that's when he runs away. Right, we understand, right, how wrong he was to subject Bria to this temptation, right, because who was he to subject her, right, and what does this have to do with Nashim Da'atan Kalod anyway, right? It certainly has nothing to do with women being easily seduced, because he, Rav Meir, male, is far more easily seduced than she is, right? She requires, right, someone to talk to her for a really long time, right, and to pester her, and finally she gives in, right, all he requires is Satan looking like a beautiful woman on the other side of the river, right, if Rav Meir had this story happen first, right, there's no way, right, that he would think anything about, right, the assumption of the story in Rashi is that women are easily seduced means that women are seducible, whereas men, of course, are impervious to temptation. Right? You know, you could have people talk to them forever and it would never happen. Right? Whereas obviously we understand from source number 3 that's not true. And Rav Meir eventually finds it out himself.
If it happened afterwards,
so of course it was a mistake. Right? And that's why he runs away, because he realizes, boy, I was really unjustified.
Yeah, but what did he be really petty?
Petty?
Yeah, because he was doing it because he had been tempted, and then he wants to tempt her the same way.
Oh, you think it happened before, right? His birth story happened afterwards. Yeah, that would be really bad. I don't even want to go there. That would be too depressing. Yes, ma'am.
That would be like a case. You have someone who makes fun of other things precisely because of the fact that he himself has that problem.
Okay, but the Gemara seems to imply, I hope that the point of the Gemara in source number 3 is that Rav Meir learns not to mock them anymore.
After the
Satan episode. Right? And therefore, I'm hoping, and that's why I'm hoping, therefore, that it happened after the Berea episode and not before. Right? Because it's just, this is going to be a depressing enough shiur as it is. Right? I don't need that. It says not sinners, but then we discover it's a temptation, or they wouldn't be parallel.
At the time that this would have been written, the Talmudic period,
yeah.
Hadn't Judaism already given up the belief in the Satan?
Well, I don't know if we ever did or didn't believe. You know, I don't necessarily have an evolutionary perspective on that.
I'm sorry?
I don't know that we necessarily, I don't have an evolutionary perspective that we believed it at one point and not. I would say is that there is a figure called the Satan going back to Eov and extending through the Talmudic period. Whether you choose to take that as representing a single angel or as a metaphor for the forces of darkness, I think you can do consistently all the way through.
Judaism had a lot of trouble when the Persians were there.
Okay, source number 4. Okay, what we're still looking for, so source number 3, we might have an understanding of how Rav Meir's part in the Berea episode comes about, right? The reason Rav Meir tempts, right? And as we understand now that the point of the Rav Meir, the Rav Meir tempting Berea, is because we know that Rav Meir has a period in his life at which he is impervious to temptation, or at least he believes himself such, and that's how he could have behaved in this way. Okay, but where do we get the idea of Berea's behavior? Story. If you want a technical answer, of course he trusted that his student, having seduced his wife verbally, wouldn't, right? His student, of course, being male, would be impervious to temptation. No, so they don't actually sin. They don't actually sin. There's no danger. Right? There's no because she's shamed, right? Because she lost, right? Because she's discovered, right? It's proven that, in fact, she is easily seduced. Well, maybe she, right? Maybe she shared his self-perception, right? She comes from a family, right? Where a daughter can, you know, preserve one's chastity in a brothel. Right, so maybe she thinks also, right, that would prove not anything about women necessarily, but right, because right, the whole thing is, right, it's astonishing that Rav Meir wants to prove that women are easily seduced, having just rescued Berea's daughter from a brothel, right, where she was impervious to temptation. So how Rav Meir can possibly believe that women are easily seduced when he knows that Berea's sister, right, is unseducible, right? It's really very strange. Well, Rav Meir in this story doesn't come off very well. Right, we'll talk about, right, we'll try and figure out why. That's true, but he doesn't actually cause her to sin, right? Because he's tempting her with a student who presumably won't sin. No, there's no situation. He's putting her in a situation where what he's doing is he's putting out, from his perspective, right, he's putting out a can of bacon bits, marked bacon, and seeing if she'll eat it. There's no danger she's going to eat bacon, right? Because there's no bacon there.
Except that the bacon is actually stewed. He's taking stewed to his prime purpose to study Talmud.
Good, we'll get there.
Right.
Good, very good, we'll get there. Excellent.
Not to mention it happened to him later on. How do you know that a student might be human?
Well, I'll tell you, we're assuming at this point that he assumed that a student is male, right? And therefore, all males are impervious to temptation. It's only women, right? It's only women who are seducible. All right. Source number 5. Source number 4, my fault. Okay, Rabbi Yossi Aglili is traveling, and he meets Berea, and he says, okay, which path should we take to Lud? And she looks at him and she says, idiot Galilean, right? Didn't the sages say, do not increase conversation with women? You should have said, which to load. Okay, now, this is right, one of the unfortunate things in rabbinic literature is that over time we lose our sense of humor. There are all sorts of things that are funny, which we don't get anymore. Right, for which one of the prime examples is that in yeshivot, one gives many, many lectures, right? This, we perhaps will talk about it some other time, based on the Gemara, which says if the sages were, right, if the earlier ones, if our ancestors were like angels, we are like men. If our ancestors were like men, we are like donkeys. Okay, and so far it's serious. And not like the donkey of Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair, right? Then we get into the story about this particular donkey, which had some kind of magical intuition about the capacity, right? Which it could tell whether particular grains had had the tithe taken from them or not. Right, and at that point, obviously, right, you know, if you have some kind of sense of humor, right, I think it's obvious that that's the line which is the joke line, right, to relieve the tension after the sharp line. But you don't necessarily get it. So in this case, I have to admit that at least one medieval authority, Rav Shlomo Mitzrach Duran, didn't get it. So he derives from this story that we learn that the prohibition against speaking overmuch with women does not only apply in terms of having conversations about things you don't have to talk about. It even means that there's an obligation to speak with women in the most economical verbal formula possible. Right? So you should not say, which way path should we take to Lud? You should say, which to Lud? Right? So we accept, right? Of course, we do that right now. We learn this halacha, of course, from Bruria. Right? We learn this halacha from Bruria, right? We learn from Bruria the proper mode of speaking with women like Bruria. Rachel Adler points out, I think, far more compellingly, that there's a bit of a paradox here. Because, right, if really one should not speak over much with women, right, so Bruria's best answer should have been, which path to Lud? That. Right? Or better yet, she should just have pointed. Idiot Galilean, that was necessary?
What's his name?
Oh, okay, so it's mutter to speak longer to teach lessons. Okay. Pardon? Yes. Yes. Galileans were rubes.
Oh, okay.
Galileans were rubes. Okay. You buy the Rashbat. Right. And maybe it only applies to men, not to women. Maybe women are entitled to talk. Right. The Gemara points out one of my mother's favorite midrashim when Shaul looks for his lost donkeys. So he stops some women and he asks them for directions, and they just chatter on for like five or six verses. Right? And he's like, what are they doing? Right? You know, he's over there, you keep going, right? Don't worry, maybe he hasn't left. Right? And so, you know, the Gemara tells you, right? My mother is like, if you've ever seen Pirates of Penzance, right? You know, the chattering women, right? You know, Shaul is the tallest man in Israel, right? So this real, right? So the tallest man in Israel shows up and asks him for directions. So they're, you know, skipping along, desperately trying to keep up, right? Over there, right? Really, no, don't worry, right? Right? So you understand that, you know, maybe it's okay for women to prolong conversations. And, you know, and we have this natural tension, right? Men are supposed to end them, women are supposed to prolong them. I don't know. Rachel Adler reads the story as follows. She says, Rav Yossi Aglili, right, is really trying to keep the halacha. So he walks up to Bria and he doesn't even say hello. Right? He says, which path should we take to Lud? Right? And she thinks that the prohibition against speaking overmuch with women does not mean that you should not show women common courtesy. Right? So she makes fun of him and extends the conversation to tell him, right? Yeah. Right, she's saying, right, and in the process, of course, she undercuts his whole purpose, right, because his whole goal was to keep the conversation as short as possible, right, and she keeps it up, she makes it much longer. I think that reading is wrong, by the way. I think that reading is wrong because I don't think that we generally have records of greetings in these conversations. Right, I think that's usually how people met. But I have a couple other questions. How did he know it was Bruria? How do we know that Bruria was the person involved in the story? Now, she can tell he's a Galilean because Galileans have an accent. But I think if I look at the story, right, you know, she said, he should have said, which to Lud, right? He says, which path should we take to Lud? In my perspective, which he's really reacting to is, we? Who said she was going to Lud? Which path should we take to Lud? Now, we all, pardon? No, it doesn't mention, there's no mention of other people there. I know. I think, a more fun reading would be, they're afraid that we all assume the brewer is already married in this story. But she's walking alone on the road. There's no reason to assume that. So, right, so Rav Yosef literally walks along, right, and there's a woman walking along the other way, and he says, so, which path should we take to Lud? Right? And she looks at him, right? She looks at him, and she just tears him to shreds. Right? Who said we? Right? And she points out that saying we, right, by the way, right, you know, obviously, scholarly looking rabbi type, you're violating halacha. Right, because that extra word "we" right violates the prohibition of altar besicha in Ma'isha. Right, so this is right. I always put this right in the list of, you know, failed Talmudic pickup lines. the really okay, you know, you take your this right. This seems to me. Well, we'll see another failed one next, right? Well, yes and no. We'll see one that both works and doesn't work next week. That right? It strikes me that's the most. I really think that's the most likely reading of the story. Of course, it'd be much more fun, right, if you assumed that the reason we know it's Beria is because, of course, he's been trying to get to meet her for years. Right, and he just happens to be lucky that she's walking along the road, right, and this is his one shot, right?
He said he was great. Yeah.
Well, we know how else do we know? She told the story later. Maybe she told the story later. Maybe he met her later. It's possible, right? That's not the proof. For me, it's just the language is enough, right? Where does we come from? But it'd be much more fun if I were writing the novel to say that, you know, they knew each other for a long time, and this was his one shot, and of course, you know, she tears him to shreds, and she ends up marrying Rav Meir instead, right? Who presumably had a better thing. And Rav Meir, of course, is noted. Rav Meir, of course, is the smartest of all of the Talmudic rabbis, right? So he could stand up to this. Rav Meir is the one who is so brilliant that we never rule like him according to one Talmudic version, because he's so smart, no one can ever tell whether his arguments are true or not, because they know whichever side of the argument he takes, he'll win. Right? So we don't rule, because in order to rule like somebody, you have to be able to evaluate the arguments. And the Gemara just said Rav Meir was too smart; nobody could tell whether he was right or not. So they just discounted him because his arguments were irrelevant. Right? So that's who she ends up marrying, right? The person who's much sharper. Yes, Yoni? Yeah. Right, that's the I think it's the most fun way of reading it. I think it's not a terrible way of reading it. In fact, I think it's the most likely way of reading it. Again, you could decide that when I talk about Talmudic humor, right? My friend Rabbi Moshe Raymond, many years ago at our teacher Rabbi Rosenzweig's house, gave a Purim drasha. Right, which the question was, right, the things that the Talmud calls milsad debidichasa, right, the jocular things opening that you're supposed to open a lecture with, right? Why aren't they funny? Right? Is it because the rabbis had a bad sense of humor, or because they had a different sense of humor which we don't get? Right? And the premise was that there's nothing funny, right? And I think he's wrong. I think there's lots of funny stuff. We just don't get it, right? You know, and if we get it, you'll see that the Talmud is full of humor in lots of places. Okay, or you can take, you know, I'm willing to admit that Rav Shlomo ben Tzemach Duran takes this as a straight halachic statement. I think that's wrong, but that's the problem, you know, the brilliant insight of deconstructionism is that the best parody is a perfect copy. Right? And so the whole point is that the best parody is indistinguishable from the real thing, and you can take it straight. It all depends on what tone of voice you read it in. Okay. If you take either Adler's or my reading, okay, what you have in this story is a precedent for Beria making fun of rabbinic statements about women. Okay, because if Beria mocked Al Tarbes Sicha in Ma'isha, right, do not speak over much with women, so then it's not a long stretch to say that Beria would have mocked Nashim Datan Kalot. Okay? Yes, it only works if you assume that she.
Showing knowing that if you take it seriously.
Yeah. That's true. If you take it seriously, there's no basis at all. But if you read it the way, right, no one wants to read it the way the Rashbats reads it, right, it's not, right, then we're left with our question, where on earth did this story come from? Right? My argument is that the only place this story could have come from, Right? The only place the story in Rashi could have come from, the only way it makes sense is if you read this story that way. Yes? Right. Okay, but start sitting sharply towards Chachamim, specific Chachamim, because she's a right, because she's a member of the class and she's better than they are. Right, we have lots of stories, right? We have other stories in which she makes fun of, right, the student who's learning in whispers and things like that. But she's not making fun of them because he's a rabbi and she makes fun of rabbis. She makes fun of them because she is part of the scholarly class and he's not good enough. Okay, right. Fundamentally, right, the key issue, right, the key identity issue is Bruria part of the rabbinic class, right, who thereby has the right to make fun, right, to critique inferiors, or is Bruria, right, as a woman outside the rabbinic class, right, who reacts to rabbinic statements as an outsider, who, right, as a brilliant outsider? That's really the question. Okay. So I gave you, right, a bunch of the other stories to try and give you a sense of what Bria's character is overall, right? So source number five, right, you see Bria speaking sharply to students, right, and there she's not in any way, right, there she's functioning within, right, there she functions within the system, right? She says the exact same thing that a male rabbi would have said to the student, right? And in fact she's echoing, right, in fact she's echoing a whole bunch of rabbinic statements that say the exact same thing. Okay, then you discover that she's not only sharp, right, that Bria just in general is sharp, right? She likes making sharp comments to people, right? So she tears Rav Yossi Haglili apart, right? And by the way, this, you know, again, it may be a very young Rav Yossi Haglili, right? And she tears, right? You know, because it says Rav Yossi Haglili doesn't mean he has smicha already, right? She could have torn apart Yussel the Galilean when he was 16 or whatever it may be. So she tears apart this heretic. Oh, that story. Source number six is really interesting. Here again, I think Adler is right, because fundamentally, right, the fun thing about it is the heretic makes fun of Bruria. Right, heretic challenges rabbinic Judaism by something like an argument, like the Talmud doesn't seem to make sense in terms of women's experience, right? Why, right? It's a verse about women, and she reverses it, right? And says, "Look, I know more about that than you do, right? And really, right? And really, what is the right? I can tell you what this verse really means." Okay. Then you have the famous story, right, in which Bruria, right, in which Bruria tells, right, Bruria tells Rav Meir, right, to pray for mercy as opposed to for their death. There are a lot of points that need to be made about this story in a different context as we're doing that story as such. For one thing, you should be aware in parallel manuscripts, it isn't ruffians at all. It's a heretic. It's a heretic who used to bother a mayor by quoting biblical verses at him in ways that he couldn't answer. Right? And so essentially, you know, so if you put these two stories together, right, and these two stories are consecutive. So if you assume that the parallel version is correct, right, so what Bruria is really telling Rav Meir is there's a better way to handle heretics, right? You just have to be sharper, right? When they come bother me, I just quote the verses back at them, right? So praying for their death, right, is just a confession of inadequacy, right? Which is why, right? And what she's doing is she's showing Rav Meir how to deal with them, right? What does she do, right? Look, you know, you have this verse, right? I'll show you, right? People quote verses at you, you quote verses back at them. All you have to do is be sharp enough, right? So if you take that parallel version, which I think is very compelling because it makes no sense, why does Rameer pray for the deaths of ruffians? Right, these kind of stories in the Talmud are almost always about heretics. Strikes me as not unlikely that you have an example of censorship going on. I can show you the parallel if you want.
There's another midrash where it says that there's a certain philosopher used to debate with Rabbi Meir. We actually know about that philosopher from other sources, so it seems Rabbi Meir
used to... Yeah. Right. It seems to me, right, far more likely, right, that if these two stories are consecutive, both of them were originally about heretics, and you have to, right, and Rabbi Meir, And Bruria's response to Rav Meir is really not so much about her being nice and kind and sweet and gentle, because we have no evidence anywhere of her so far of her being nice and kind and sweet and gentle. It's not her character at all. It's just it's sort of a double shtuch, to say Nishivish, right? Because she tells him what he's doing is wrong, and in the process she tells him how to do it right. Right, but the reason it's wrong is because if he did it right, he wouldn't have to do this. Okay. Source number eight and nine, right, are just the primary sources where we discover that Bruria is not only, source number eight is a primary source for discussing how, source number 9 and 10 in English, and 8 and 10 in the Hebrew, I apologize for that, are both stories where we discover that Bruria is a great scholar, right? In one of which, Rabbi Yochanan tells somebody, right, who wants to learn Divrei Hayamim with him, look, Bruria, right, who, you know, learned 300 things from 300 different teachers in one day, couldn't finish this in a couple of months, and you want to finish it in whatever the time is, right? You want to finish it in 3 months, right? And she couldn't finish it in 3 years, right? So we know that Bruria learned a lot. And the other story is where there's a halachic dispute in which Bruria defeats her brother, right? Where the rabbis say that Bruria is better than her brother. Okay, and then finally you get to the story which really defines Bruria in a lot of the culture, right? Which is the story of which Bruria consoles Rav Meir, right? But with this marvelous parable, right? In which she tells him that a man left something with me, do I have to return it? Right, and Rav Meir says, of course you have to return it, and then she tells him, right, quoting Eov, right, well, I just returned my sons to God. Okay, that story is really, really anomalous in that we find Bruria addressing Rav Meir as Revi. Rav Meir calls his wife my daughter. It's not clear to me at all that this story fits very well with the rest of the stories. To the extent it does, the only thing that really fits is that she has a cool verse to make her point. But what is perhaps somewhat interesting about this story, right, is this is a story in which a man is going to go to pieces emotionally, right, and a cool, calm, rationally collected woman citing verses, right, prepares him for it, right, and she expresses no emotion at all throughout this whole story, right. She's just a scholar. She sets it up, right. So this is a story, right, in which the stereotypical roles of men and women are reversed. Well, even though rhetorically he is the Rebbe and she's the daughter, right? But behaviorally, right, she's the Rebbe and he's the student. Yes.
There's one line where he says, "Of course you have to return it," and she says, "Had you not said that, I would not have returned it."
Right, because because formally he's the Rebbe.
Right.
But practically, right, she's the one behaving like the Rebbe.
I mean, the line earlier where she says, "Kus midat halohai is manseraso." So, in other words, it sounds like she's weaker. She would not have so readily agreed to give it back, to give her kid back.
I don't know. Maybe she's just telling that to him. I don't know. Maybe just in kind of the dialogue, right? If you hadn't said that, right? Of course, I feel as strongly as you, but.
Oh.
Right. There's also a fun pun in the story, right? Where Meir says, right? Where Meir talks about his sons that they were Meir Einav Batorah, right? Right. So, you know, that's where you get the sense, right? The sons were what made him what he is. Right, so you read the story, right? It's beautiful that way. Okay. Where's Chani ben Tradion may be the same person as Chani ben Tradion, assuming that they are. I assume they are, yeah, then it's her father. So they asked her brother and they asked her, right? And that's what it said. The daughter said better than the son. Okay. What do we do with the narrative as a whole? So, right, so what we've shown, okay, is that you can build up a character of Bruria as a sharp-tongued and brilliant Talmudic scholar. There are two stories which seem to show sort of a feminine side to her in that she uses her scholarship to bring emotional peace and or to convince her husband to be nice. I think I've done a fairly effective job of certainly deconstructing the dialogue with her husband, the one with her husband about the ruffians. And I say, I'm not so sure that I would really make the other story part of it. The other story comes from a very, very late Midrash. Right, and I have my doubts about the extent to which that's really part of the story. The one about, you know, the two sons. And even if it is, right, and I don't know that it affects an overall reading of the character. Okay, so we have, right, we have a story, right, and I'll give you, right, I'll give you this version, right, the version, the way Rachel Adler gives you a retelling of the story. Okay, this is the Berea story. Once there was a woman named Berea, and she was a great Talmudic scholar. She was the daughter of the great Palestinian Rabbi Hananiah ben Tradion, who was martyred by the Romans. Even as a young girl, she far outstripped her brother as a scholar. It was said that she had learned 300 laws from 300 teachers in one day. She married Rav Meir, the miracle worker and great Mishnaic sage. One time when Rav Meir prayed for some robbers to die, Berea taught him to pray that their sin would die, that they would repent. She also taught, by the way, that's not shot in what her argument is either. It's nothing to do with sins. But that's a separate issue. Right? People think that she says, right, the sinner, she really says, according to Rashi, that pray for their capacity, for their evil inclination to cease, not pray for the sins to cease. But again, if we ever do that story in self, we can discuss that. She also taught Meir resignation when the two sons died. Loving and gentle as she was with Meir, Berea could also be arrogant and biting. She ridiculed the Sadducee, derided an erring student, and made a fool of Rabbi Yossi the Galilean when he met her on the road. Finally, she mocked the sage's dictum that women are easily seduced, and she came to a shameful end. Rav Meir set one of his students to seduce her. After long denial, she yielded to him. When the plot was revealed, she strangled herself. Rav Meir fled to Babylonia because of the disgrace. Okay, that's what she claims. That's the story of Berea. What we showed, right, we showed was that the story, right, the capstone of the story, right, which, right, what leaves, or otherwise would be a beautiful character, right, that with a bad taste in her mind, is the story in Rashi. And I tried to show you where I think that story comes from, right? That you have, right, that you find, right, you can find, certainly Berea is biting, and you can even find one story in which Berea is biting towards the words of the sages, if you accept my reading. And that, right, and so that is what justifies this reading. But what really is behind this reading, right? Why would one tell the story that way? Right? Why doesn't one have a story in which Berea commits suicide? Right? Why does she have to end that way? Virginia Woolf, that's the other acknowledgement, which Rachel Adler does not for some reason. Either really it's just a case of incredible parallel development, or that she just forgot in the footnotes. Virginia Woolf has a beautiful essay called Shakespeare's Sister, in which she tries to envision what it would have been like to have all of Shakespeare's talent, but be female in Elizabethan England. And she tells you the story, you know, that I don't know, Wilhelmina, right? Who discovers her talent for writing at an early age, right? Tries to find someone to teach her to it, but can't. Right? She shows up at the stage house, but they tell her that women aren't allowed to act. Right? And she goes through every aspect, and tries to do all the things that her brother William does, and in all aspects where she's incapable of expressing her talent. And the result of it is she throws herself under a stagecoach and commits suicide, because the argument is, right, in that kind of society, there's no way a woman with that kind of talent could live with herself. Okay, that's Shakespeare's Sister. Rachel Adler makes the argument the following way. She says, who is Berea? Well, we know that Berea is brilliant. Okay, but if we look at how we find out about Berea's brilliance, the stories in which we find out about Berea's brilliance are, number one, in which Rav Yochanan makes fun of a male student for suggesting he can do something that even, right, that Berea couldn't, and we find that she wins an argument with her brother. Okay, we find out further that at least either this brother or another brother ends up actually being murdered in unfortunate circumstances, because he has yatzala tarbut ra'a. Right, he has gone off. Right, he's gone into bad ways. So he's gone into bad ways. Right, you know, he takes up with bad companions, and they eventually murder him. So Adler argues that what Berea is, right, is, right, the son that Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion never had. Right, the worthy successor of Rabbi Chanina ben Tradion. And okay, so now we have that stage number one. Stage number two, she says, is maybe what Berea is what a woman would, right, is the attempt to try and figure out what would it be like, right, the brilliant phrase she has, right, the rabbi's thinking, what would it be like if there were a woman who was just like us? Right, and so right, they endow, right, so she comes across exactly as a prominent rabbinic scholar, right? She behaves like teachers do to students. Right? So what's the long-term prognosis of a woman in Talmudic culture who is just like them? So her argument is that right, that the rabbis imagining her properly, right? And again, right, we leave out the question, right? They may not have had to imagine her. She may have, right, she may have really been that way in large measure, but for our purposes, right, we're taking her as a literary character. They realize that over time, she would understand that her existence, right, her existence didn't work, right, because so many of the thing, of the, so much of the culture she was master of said she couldn't exist, right, she's supposed to be, right, because she has all this talent for participating in halachic discourse, but they won't talk to her, because al tarba sicha ma'isha, right, she's supposed to be a moral example, but nashim datan kalot. Right, and so right, and so number one, she argues, Bria herself, right, would start being sarcastic, because she couldn't, right, because the tension there was so great, and number two, the men couldn't deal with it because she would be disproving so many of their. Because right, if the men live in a culture which is predicated on the truth of these statements, right, and here is this woman messing up their statements, and so they would go to any length. Right, to prove that, right, that in fact she wasn't an exception. Okay, and so Rav Meir, right, and so Rav Meir, right, as you pointed out earlier, right, Rav Meir goes to all lengths, right, to the point that Rav Meir undercuts the whole basis of the culture he's trying to defend. Right, he violates Lifnei Iver, right, he violates the relationship between husband and wife, right, so he violates the premise of his own gender relationship, right, which is that husbands are supposed to protect wives. Right, husbands are supposed to guard their wives against temptation because wives are easily seduced. Instead, he sends his wife into temptation. And right, if the whole goal is to preserve the male Talmudic culture, what does he do? He uses a student, right, as a pawn in his own, right, as a pawn in his own game. Right, so the mayor perverts all the relationships critical to Talmudic culture to preserve it against the threat of this anomalous woman. Okay, that's Rachel Adler's reading. And she argues that this is inevitable, right? That just as Shakespeare's sister has to commit suicide, so too Bruria's sister has to be driven to commit suicide. Bruria has to be driven to commit suicide. And the story only makes sense, right? The story can only end the way, right, with Rashi's story. Because you couldn't have the story end with just this woman existing, because that creates too many problems. Okay, there's a point to which I accept that analysis, and there's a point to which I think that analysis is happily right. If that were so, I would just be massively depressed. But there's a point to which I think it's also wrong. And that, I think, is true empirically and possibly textually. The empirical disproof is, first of all, so far as we can tell, nobody in Sfarad, nobody in Spanish Jewish culture ever knew this story. Okay? Again, we have no source for this outside of Rashi. Okay? It's not retold anywhere. Which means to me that there was a culture, right? A very prominent halachic culture, that was perfectly capable of living with Bruya as she was. She doesn't have to commit suicide, right? There's just the Bruya, right, who's Rav Meir's wife, who's, right, who functions in this culture, who's brilliant, and we're perfectly fine with that. We quote her. Furthermore, I think that we live in a culture like that. And there are endless number of schools named after Bruya, right? Women's schools named after Bruya. If people thought that the inevitable end of a character like Bruya was that they end up being seduced and committing suicide, Right? Can you imagine if you even thought, right, if anyone even thought ever, when they thought of Bruja, oh, that's the right, that's the woman who ended up being seduced and committing suicide, there wouldn't be a single institution in, right, in Judaism that was named after her. Right? Which means that we live in a culture in which this is not the end of the story. Okay? Or, right, we live in a culture in which we understand that shouldn't have been the end of the story. There wouldn't be a single school, there wouldn't be a single institution named after Bruja, right? If anyone's association when they heard the name Bruja was that woman, right, that anomalous woman, right, who learned too much, ended up becoming arrogant, mocking the sages, and, right, and met a justified end. Right? It's not conceivable you would send, right, anyone would consider sending their daughters. Right? That's what we wanted to grow up just like Bruja. That's for sure. Right? It's not possible. Which means that we live in a culture in which that story doesn't exist. One possibility. Or we live in a culture in which we understand that that story shouldn't, at least we understand that story shouldn't have existed, not because there shouldn't have been a Bruja, but because what happened to her was, right, was not her fault, right, but in fact was the product, right, was the product of a culture which failed improperly, right, to accommodate her. As we can say, that the point, right, maybe we can even say that the point of the story in Rashi is not to tell us that Bruja came to a bad end, right, because the Gemara quotes the story not to tell us anything about Bruja. The Gemara tells the story to tell us why Rav Meir had to leave his own culture, right? The only reason we ever find out about the story, right, is to tell us why it is that Rav Meir gets ejected from his culture. Okay, meaning the message of the story, right, is, right, the reason we tell the story is to tell us how tragic the consequences are when men can't deal, right, with there being women, right, who are not, right, who are just like them. Right, and even though it's true that Bruja gives in, but that's because, right, that's because culturally, right, she's under assault. And there's no reason for it, right? And if you read the Rav Meir story in the context of what we saw earlier, the story of Rav Meir and temptation, right, then we understand, right, of course, right, anyone knowing that Rav Meir, right, that Rav Meir's behavior here, right, is ridiculous because he himself is, right, is subject, would give in much more easily than Bruja, can't possibly think that this tells us anything about Bruja. Okay, right? More to the point, right, the story, right, you have to read the story and wonder, why didn't the heavenly voice, right, why didn't heavenly voice appear and, right, and save Bruja? Well, the answer is because Rav Meir was lucky and he was tempted by an angel, and Bruja was tempted by human beings who were tempting Bruja weren't listening for heavenly voices. And for all we know, right, there was a voice saying he's Zari B'Bruja over Torato, but Rav Meir's student didn't hear it. Rav Meir didn't hear it. So what I would argue is that Adler's reading of Bruja's character is right on. Perhaps even, right, she softens it in a way, right? She softens her in a way that I don't necessarily accept. I don't think there's any softness in Bruja's character at all. But whereas Adler argues that, right, that therefore we should take this as a stunning critique of rabbinic culture, right? Look, rabbinic culture can't deal with women like Bruja. I think that that's, right, so an empirical misreading of the culture of Baruch Hashem, and possibly a bad misreading of the story itself. Right? Maybe the whole point of the story is to teach us not to behave that way. And if that's the case, then, you know, Baruch Hashem, we live for the first time, perhaps, in a culture which really understands the story. Right? Because it's the first time, it's the first culture which has, right, which really names institutions after Bruja, which is going out, right, rather than being afraid of women who intellectually are our equals, right? But at least, you know, my perspective, what I'm trying to do the best I can is to create is to do the best we can to create women who are our equals. So I hope that we'll succeed, right? And we will we'll continue to live in a culture in which the story of Bruja as told in the Gemara is an inspiration, and the story of Bruja as told in Rashi is either forgotten or a caution. Thank you, you've been a great audience.